Night had come to Tombstone. Sam Two Wolves and Matt Bodine stood outside the Hotel Earl, the best hotel in town, and there were some fine hotels in town. The Hotel Earl was located on busy, bustling Allen Street, Tombstone's main thoroughfare, in the heart of the lively commercial district. It stood between 4th Street and 5th Street, on the same stretch of prime real estate as the Cosmopolitan Hotel and the Occidental Hotel, two other outstanding establishments. Farther along the street was the Oriental Saloon, site of the recent high-stakes poker game featuring some of Tombstone's most celebrated citizens. Matt and Sam had made almost $200 this day, selling off the Volun Gang's horses, guns, and saddles. After leaving the marshal's office, they went to a dry goods store to buy some new clothes, following which they went to a bathhouse to get cleaned up. They put on their new clothes and left their old ones wrapped up in a brown paper parcel held in a bin under the front counter for later retrieval.
Yeah, we're early.
That gives us time for a word with Buckskin Frank, who tipped us to this deal.
Time for a drink, too.
They climbed the stairs and went inside into the front hall. The interior blazed with light, reflections glimmering on brass and bronze fittings and dark wood paneling. A wide central staircase led to the second floor. To the right was the front desk and a restaurant. To the left was a lobby, beyond which lay the bar. People came and went, hotel guests and visitors, restaurant and bar patrons. A lot of business deals were done in the lobby and bar room. Matt and Sam went through the lobby into the bar room. A long bar stretched along the rear wall. It was a stand-up bar with a brass rail along the foot, no chairs or stools. Tables and chairs were grouped around the space. There was a good-sized crowd, some hotel guests, some not. Most looked to be of the business class. Among the men, there were less belt guns to be seen on average than on the streets of Tombstone. Some carried concealed weapons, no doubt. Others relied on their wits, well-stuffed wallets, or both. One of the barmen was Frank Leslie, clad in a trademark fringed buckskin shirt. He was armed. A gunman of renown such as he must go armed at work or play. Seeing Matt and Sam approaching, he finished the drink he was making and handed it to a patron with a flourish. He wiped his hands on a hand towel and came out from behind the bar, crossing to Matt and Sam. They shook hands.
You two look all dooted up.
We want to make a good impression.
You want to make a good impression on the Colonel, you got to show him how he can make some money. A whole lot of money.
Well, that's what we're here for.
The Colonel's looking forward to meeting you. He made a point of saying how much he wanted to meet some of the famous gunmen of Tombstone, so I naturally thought of you.
Well, we're not so famous.
No, but the other famous gunmen are on the Wells Fargo posse.
What's the matter? Weren't you famous enough for him?
He's already met me. Besides, I don't have a silver claim. You do.
Tell me, Frank, did you know Colonel Davenport was coming for a visit when you tried to buy our claim this morning? You don't have to answer that. I already know the answer. Of course you did. You work here at the hotel, so you know when important guests are coming.
Business is business, Matt. You can't blame a man for trying. With those poker winnings in hand, I tried to make hay while the sun shines. Guess I got a little carried away. But I'm making amends by steering you to the Colonel.
And we appreciate it.
I gave you a big build-up with the old boy, telling him about some of your adventures. He's mighty keen on meeting real Westerners.
Well, it might have helped if you gave the claim a big build-up.
I know you boys can shoot. I don't know that your claim's a silver motherlode.
You thought enough of it to try to buy it.
I'm a gambler, remember?
That's water under the bridge.
My sentiments exactly. Time to move past that. Sail the hell out of the claim to the Colonel and good luck.
Thanks, Frank. Anything we should know about the setup before we walk in?
Colonel Davenport's got an assistant with the name of Stebbins. A private secretary or bookkeeper or something. Keeps an eye on the Colonel's money for him. He's a real tight ass and a cheapskate. He squeezes a dollar so hard the eagle screams. You could be giving away solid silver bars and he'd still say nay. He don't tip worth a damn neither, the waiters and chambermaids tell me.
We'll keep it in mind. Anything else?
The Colonel's got another fellow traveling with him. Kind of a mysterious hombre. Name of Mark Hand. Not a money man. He's an agent for a European arms maker. Got some kind of invention he's touting to Davenport, trying to get him to invest. Some kind of fancy gun or something. That's all I know.
Ferner?
No, he's American. Creole from New Orleans. But he's been around. Looks like he can take care of himself in a pinch. How about that Wells Fargo robbery? That sure was some sweet haul.
$27,000.
I'd like to get my hands on that.
Who do you think did it? You get around, Frank. A bartender hears all kinds of things on the grapevine. Any ideas who the robbers are?
Well, it happened an hour after sunup. I was with you at the time. So I know you didn't do it, and you know I didn't do it. Ringo and Curly Bill were there with us, so that lets them out. Otherwise, they'd be a logical choice.
We know who didn't do it. Who did?
I'm not making accusations, mind. And you didn't hear it from me. But sure would be interesting to know where Doc Holliday was when that bouillon wagon was hit.
Doc's on the posse hunting the robbers.
What of it? The posse didn't go out till 2 in the afternoon, if not later. Plenty of time for Doc to get back to town and set up an alibi. And here's another thing. The robbers burned down Cooper, the shotgun messenger, right straight off, and tried to kill the driver, Sims, too. Cooper and Sims both know Doc pretty well. Could be they recognized him even with a mask on, or Doc thought they did, so he decided to take care of them permanent-like.
Well, I'm not saying Doc wouldn't do it if he had the chance, but what about Wyatt Earp? Doc's his right-hand man. I got no love for Wyatt, but I can't see him tying into something as raw as this.
Wyatt looks the other way when it comes to Doc. There's a lot about Doc Holliday that Wyatt don't know because he don't want to know. All right. I jawed long enough. I gotta get back to work.
We better get moving, too, or we'll be late for our meeting.
You don't want to do that. Davenport's supposed to be a stickler about punctuality.
One thing puzzles me. You never gave away something for nothing in your life, Frank. What's in it for you steering us to the colonel?
I'm just doing a good turn. If you close a deal, you might want to do me one by paying me a finder's fee.
Nah, it makes sense.
If it's a go, we'll cut you in for a slice, Frank.
I knew I could count on you. Good luck, man. Let me know how it comes out.
Buckskin Frank went back behind the bar.
That Frank's a slippery cuss. He's probably got it rigged for Davenport to pay him a finder's fee if the deal goes through, too.
Let's not keep the great man waiting.
Colonel Davenport's room was upstairs on the second floor, room 208, the so-called presidential suite. Best room in the house. Sam and Matt stood outside the door. The door opened almost as soon as Sam finished knocking, as though a person within it had been standing there waiting. Beyond the threshold lay a short, narrow vestibule opening on a large drawing room. The doorkeeper was lean and lank, with bony shoulder knobs, elbows, and knees. Thin, spidery, colorless hair webbed his high-domed head. His face was long and mournful, with close-set eyes, turnip-shaped nose, and a tight mouth pursed in an expression of disapproval. He was clean-shaven, but with prominent mutton-chop side whiskers. He wore a black frock coat, stiff white collar, and a gray-patterned cravat.
Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves to see Colonel Davenport. We're expected.
Well, come in, please. I'm Arnholt Stebbins, Colonel Davenport's confidential assistant.
Glad to know you.
Quiet. This way, please.
Matt and Sam followed Stebbins into the drawing room. Other rooms opened off it to the left and right. The drawing room was large, expansive, well-appointed, and furnished. Two men stood standing and talking, with well-filled glasses in hand, puffing away on fat, aromatic cigars. One was white-haired with a white mustache, the other a younger man with black hair and finely cut features.
Colonel Davenport, this is Mr. Bodine and Mr. Wolves.
Two Wolves. The name is Sam Two Wolves. Mr. Two Wolves.
Whatever your name is, I'm damn glad to meet you.
Colonel Holland Davenport stepped forward. He was 65, short, with short, neatly parted snowy hair, tufted white eyebrows, a bushy white mustache, and shiny pink skin. He looked well set up in the ways of good living, comfortably padded, custom tailored. Davenport reached out to shake Sam's hand. The colonel's hands were smooth and uncalloused, but his grip was strong. He shook Matt's hand, too.
Allow me to introduce an associate of mine, Mr. Remy Marcand.
Marcand, 40, was several inches above medium height with an athletic build. He had black hair, blue eyes, and a black Van Dyke mustache and goatee. His hair had blue highlights. It was so shiny it looked lacquered. His skin was bronzed, weathered, the skin of an outdoorsman. His eyebrows were arched in the centers, and his goatee came to a sharp point, giving him something of a Mephisto look. A good-humored Mephisto, with a quick, friendly smile. Markhand and the duo shook hands all around. Markhand's grip was firm and dry.
A historic encounter. The Brothers of the Wolf meeting the Panther of the Atlas. Oh, yes, I'm well acquainted with your background, gentlemen. One white boy, one red. Both raised among the Cheyenne. The Brothers of the Wolf. Blood brothers and fighting men, roaming the West in search of adventure. It's my distinct pleasure to present you to Captain Remy Markhand, late of the French Foreign Legion, whose bold exploits against the Riffian Berbers and the Blue Men of the Tuareg in the colonies of Algiers and Morocco earned him the sobriquet Panther of the Atlas Mountains.
Ah, that was long ago and far away, Colonel.
Oh, valor lives forever, my fine young sir, as you and Messrs. Bodine and Two Worlds will come to realize in the future, if you don't already.
In this day and age, it seems one is only as good as his next exploit.
Well put. Doubtless more exciting adventures lie in wait for all three of you.
Oh, I hope not. I could use a rest from being shot at.
I know what you mean.
What are you drinking, men?
Whiskey.
Hop to it, Stebbins. Serve them out. We've got some thirsty men here. Markhand and I could use another round, too.
Stebbins hovered over the sideboard, pouring the drinks. Whiskey for the duo, bourbon for Markhand, brandy for Davenport.
A toast, gentlemen.
Davenport hoisted a glass.
To adventure.
Everyone drank up, draining their glasses. Stebbins hovered around the edges, not drinking. He refilled the glasses.
I want to hear all about your thrilling exploits, shooting away across the map from hell to Texas.
Sometimes there's not much difference, Colonel.
Hey, what? How's that again?
Not much difference between hell and Texas.
Oh, just, yes, I get it. I've been to Texas. And I'm destined to spend the afterlife sizzling on a hot spit in the other place, if you believe my critics. Personally, I ignore them. Have a cigar, Bodine.
Well, thanks, Colonel.
They're Cubans, Monte Cristo, specially cut, cured, and hand-rolled to my specifications. Half a cigar, Two Wolves.
Thank you kindly, sir.
Stebbins held out a lit match, and Sam and Matt puffed away, lighting up.
Ooh, damn fine cigar, Colonel.
The foursome smoked and drank for a bit before Colonel Davenport started up again.
Hey, you Brothers of the Wolf being fighting men, I've got something to show you that'll fill you with awe and wonderment. Awe and wonderment, I say. Or rather, Markhand will say. He'll do the talking. It's his baby.
Now, hardly that, Colonel Davenport. I'm not the inventor, merely the sales agent for the North American region. I will concede that nothing sells like sincere admiration, and I have all that and more for our product. I am a true believer in the Montagny Mitrailleuse.
Matt and Sam exchanged blank glances.
I don't know the name. Is it some kind of gun?
Oh, is it some kind of gun? Oh, that's a good one, eh, Markhand? Is it some kind of gun? Why, it's the very devil of a gun, Bodine. The very devil. But seeing is believing. What say you give them a peek, Markhand?
I would be delighted, Colonel, if you gentlemen would come this way.
Markhand crossed the drawing room and passed under an archway. The others followed. Beyond the arch lay another room, part of the suite. Its far wall had several windows in it that opened on a balcony, and beyond that, Allen Street. The windows were open. Shadowy figures could be seen on the balcony.
Men outside.
They work for me, standing guard over the mitrailleuse. Can't risk a hotel sneak thief making off with a mechanical wonder of the age.
A wise precaution.
Colonel Davenport leaves nothing to chance.
The room was a dining room, its centerpiece a large, sturdy table covered with a white linen tablecloth. Instead of being set with plates and cutlery, the table served as a platform for a unique piece of weaponry. It was the height of incongruity, this futuristic armament laid out for display on a white-covered dining table. The piece was all gleaming curves and sharp edges, reflected lamplight glimmering along its shiny surfaces. Matt and Sam moved in, circling the table to eye the piece. A 3-foot-long metal cylinder was mounted on a tripod stand. One end of the cylinder was encased in an oblong housing or shell, taking up 1/3 of its total length. The other 2/3 consisted of the cylinder itself, a pipe barrel 6 inches in diameter. The muzzle was covered by a metal disc, sieved with several dozen regularly spaced holes. A square plate hung down from the underside where the barrel met the oblong receiver box. The bottom of the box was supported by a short, thick vertical rod girded round with wheels and springs. The rod fitted into a housing at the top of the tripod. A curved handle rose vertically out of the top of the rear of the housing.
I give you the Montagny Mitrailleuse.
Looks like a vest pocket Gatling gun.
Oh, hear that, my kind. A vest pocket Gatling gun. Not bad, eh? He's got you there.
In truth, it is not unlike a Gatling gun, though profoundly improved, lighter, more portable. At the home office, we like to call it a machine gun.
Matt, fascinated, lightly fingered the many bores in the circular muzzle disc.
These bores, they're each part of a separate barrel?
That is correct. The cylinders hold 37 barrels inside. They are connected to a metal plate which holds 37 cartridges. The cartridge plate can be quickly removed at the press of a button, extracting an empty plate, loading a full one. The mitrailleuse is a multi-barreled man-powered piece. The gunner turns this hand crank to fire the weapon. A switch permits either single-shot firing or a single tremendous volley. In either case, the effect, I assure you, is formidable. Devastating.
Markand is the North American sales representative for the arms maker. What say you, men?
One of the damnedest things I've ever seen.
Sure does beat all if it does what you say.
It does all that and more.
I'd buy one right now, except I can't fit it in my holster.
I'm going to put on a demonstration tomorrow. I invite you both to attend as my guest.
I accept.
I'll be there. I wouldn't miss it.
I knew you fighting men would appreciate the piece. I'm thinking of acquiring the North American rights for my combine. But speaking of acquisitions, I'm given to understand that you men have some sort of a proposition for me. Something about a silver mine claim?
Sam and Matt took their gazes away from the machine gun and looked directly at Davenport.
You're a businessman, Colonel. And time is money. So we'll get right to it. As you said, seeing is believing. Why don't you show him the samples, Matt?
Matt reached into the inside breast pocket of his jacket and took out a cloth pouch. Opening its drawstring mouth, he upended it and spilled out a handful of silver nuggets.
Samples from our claim at Spearblade Spur. We'll give you a copy of the assayer's report, but I'm sure you'll want to have your own people run the tests on it to prove it out.
Handsome specimen.
Davenport picked up a nugget between thumb and forefinger and held it up to the light.
Well, there's more where that came from.
How much more?
Remains to be seen. We're prospectors, not miners. We've struck a vein that could be the leading head of a lode. But we need funds to do the extraction, and better see what it is exactly we've got.
Are you interested in acquiring a partner or selling the claim outright?
It's negotiable. Why not come out to Spearblade Spur and see for yourself? Bring your people, your geologists and engineers. We got nothing to hide. We're an open book.
What the devil is all that fuss?
I'll see what it is, Colonel.
Stebbins went to one of the open windows. Two armed guards in civilian clothes stood at the balcony rail, staring down into the street.
You men there, what's happening in the street?
I don't know, Mr. Stebbins. Looks like a riot is breaking out.
It was about 8:30 that night at Ben Burnham's Big Sky Saloon, located on a side street at the edge of Tombstone Town. It was a companionable meeting place, offering decent whiskey and beer at a reasonable price, straightforward and with no frills. Genial but fast shooting if riled, owner-host Ben Burnham dispensed drinks from behind a trestle table bar. There was sawdust on the floor. The barmaids were a bit frayed at the edges, but not bad-looking, especially once you had a couple of drinks in you. The Big Sky was a favorite of the cowboy set. Ringo and Curly Bill often held court here when they were in town, as they were now. The saloon was doing a lively business this night. The absence of the sheriff and his deputies, and the much despised by the cowboys, Earp brothers, contributed to a celebratory mood. Patrons were packed too deep at the bar, and all the tables and chairs were filled. The overflow crowd stood at the rear of the building, whiskey glasses and beer mugs in hand. Among the patrons were Johnny Ringo and Curly Bill Brocious. They sat up front at one of the best tables in the house, along with some of the inner circle, fast guns and faster women. Ringo's current lady friend clung to his arm. Bill sat between two femmes, an arm around each of their shoulders while they snuggled in tight. Arlene was with Ringo, Ginny and Sue cuddled up with Curly Bill. Arlene was in her late teens, with short, dark reddish-brown hair cut in bangs over a heart-shaped face. Her features were finely made, but her dark blue eyes were hard, and there was a bitter twist to her provocatively shaped mouth. Her slim figure was exquisite. Sue was short, petite, and busty, with chestnut hair curling up at the edges in a flip at her shoulders. Ginny was a big blonde, green-eyed, creamy-skinned, high-breasted, and long-legged. Ringo sat slouched back in his chair, long legs extended. His eyes were hooded, and the corners of his lips quirked upward. He seemed to be enjoying himself. He was about as relaxed and happy as he ever got, which wasn't much. He was a man with a lot on his mind. No one knew what was haunting him, not even Curly Bill, his best friend. Bill never asked, either. Maybe that's why he was Ringo's best friend. Arlene clung to Ringo like a starfish gripping a clam whose shell it's trying to pry open.
I've picked you out of all the rest, John. A lot of men would give plenty to be in your shoes, to be with me. Don't you think I'm pretty? I said, don't you think I'm pretty, Johnny?
Sure.
Do you know how lucky you are to have a beautiful woman like me? Buy me another, Johnny.
You had plenty.
I want another.
Where you put it all?
You should talk.
I can hold my liquor.
So can I. I'm fine, perfectly fine.
Think so, huh?
That Kate Elder isn't so much. Do you think she's pretty? She's not as pretty as me. Don't you think I'm prettier? She's old. She's got a lot of miles on her. Been over a lot of bad road. Kate belongs with a busted down drunk like Doc Holliday.
Don't you ever shut up!
Why can't you be nice to me? Sure, McMasters is.
You like him so well, why don't you go with him? That I won't have to listen to you running off at the mouth.
You're mean. How come you're so mean?
Too many women like you.
Suddenly, a newcomer burst into the saloon. Ringo's head whipped around, his long-necked head bobbing like a striking rattlesnake's to pin the intruder with a forbidding glare. Ringo was wild of eye, grim of aspect. Curly Bill fastened a hand on Ringo's upper arm, the arm of his gun hand, which had gone to the ivory-handled grip of his holstered Colt.
Whoa, John. That's Jeb Harris. Jeb, friend of ours. Look at him. He's all worked up. Something's wrong.
Jeb Harris, the new entrant, was a disorderly character at the best of times, which this obviously was not. He was ungainly, big-gutted, with a soft moon face and moist dark eyes bulging behind oval lenses of wire-rimmed spectacles. His eyes widened farther still when he saw how Ringo was looking at him, but he pressed on, making his way to the table. Ringo's sixth sense for trouble kicked in, and he held his hand.
Lord, Johnny, you should see your face. You look like you won't kill me.
What is it? What do you want?
Well, you better come with me, John. You too, Bill.
What's got you in an uproar, Jeb?
Let come quick, there's trouble over at the jailhouse.
The crowd milled around the front of the Tombstone Jail, site of the marshal's office. More people were arrowing toward the scene by the minute, clustering together, rubbernecking, buzzing. A rising moon caused the gallows to throw long shadows westward across the square. A wagon and horse team stood outside the jailhouse, showing the effects of a long, hard ride. Curly Bill got a good look at the driver.
Lee Lindsay!
The driver shook off his blank stare, looking around to see who was calling him by name, and spotting Bill and Ringo surging to the fore. Lee Lindsay, for it was indeed him, climbed down heavily from the wagon. Unsteady on his feet, he gripped a sidewall for balance. Ringo and Bill made their way to him. Lindsay started toward them, stiff-legged, staggering. He stumbled. Ringo and Curly Bill caught him, keeping him from falling.
Don't mind me, boys. I'm tuckered out.
What are you doing here, Hoss? Thought you was over to Cactus Patch.
I was. Me and Don Brown rode a long way fast to find you.
Where's Don?
Inside with the girl.
The girl's that?
Well, she's at the heart of it. It's murder, boys. Murder. And worse.
Who got killed?
Let me go. I can stand now.
They released him. Lindsay made his shaky way to the back of the wagon. The tailgate was down. Inside on the wagon bed, covered by a dark green horse blanket, lay the unmistakable outline of a human body. A hand protruded beyond the blanket's edge. It lay palm up, fingers curling, stiff, chalk white.
Who is it?
Bob Farr.
Ringo reached into the wagon, turning the blanket down, exposing Farr's head, shoulders, and chest. His eyes were closed. They'd been closed for him by one of his handlers. His pale, bloodless face was carved into a mask of shocked surprise.
He was shot in the back.
Who did it?
Dorado, the Mex bandit with the golden gun.
I heard of him. I always thought that golden gun story was a legend.
It's not, and he wasn't alone.
Who else?
Quirt Fain.
I know Quirt. He should have been killed long ago.
He's got his time now. Him and Dorado both.
The Citizens Committee had been instrumental in having Fred White appointed Marshal of Tombstone. They represented the mine owners, leading merchants, and big ranchers. But there was an election coming up, and if White wanted to stay Marshal, he needed a majority of votes. The town folks' allegiance was split between the big business faction and the cowboys. The small shopkeepers, mine workers, and small ranchers tended to side with the cowboys. They didn't much care if the big ranchers lost stock to rustlers, and they resented the heavy-handed methods of the sheriff and his deputies, the Earps, in laying down the law. Marshal White had to walk a fine line between the businessmen and the cowboys. Deputy Johnny Behan was an outright cowboy partisan. Assistant Deputy Hubert Osgood took his cue from Behan, a canny politician and rising man in town. Osgood played to the cowboys, especially with Marshal White out of town on a posse chasing the Wells Fargo robbers. Now present in the marshal's office were Osgood, Ringo, Curly Bill, Lee Lindsay, and Don Brown. Rumors and wild tales about the incident in Cactus Patch had spread like wildfire in Tombstone, causing the occupants of the hotels and saloons of Allen Street to take to the street to hear the latest news. It was their excited clamoring which created a hubbub in front of the Hotel Earl, interrupting Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves as they pitched their silver claim on Spearblade Spur to Colonel Davenport. Davenport himself took an interest in the case, not enough to cause him to bestir himself forth from the Hotel Earl, but enough to send his representatives Arnhold Stebbins and Remy Marcan to the jailhouse to investigate. Davenport's millionaire status ensured that Assistant Deputy Osgood was most attentive to his wishes. The Brothers of the Wolf, themselves intensely curious about the incident, attached themselves to Stebbins and Marcand, using them to gain entry to the Marshal's office. Harry Woods, editor of the pro-cowboy newspaper The Nugget, gained access to the scene. Also there were Lee Lindsay and Don Brown, who'd been there for the shootout in Cactus Patch and had brought eyewitness Linda Gordon to Tombstone. Sam and Matt stood off to one side, eyeing Ringo and Curly Bill, who were eyeing them.
What are you doing here?
Bob Farr was a friend of mine.
Mine too.
He was shot in the back.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, somebody's going to be a whole lot sorrier. What brings you here?
Good citizenship.
We like to help people.
That what you were doing when you shot Justin Ballin?
He tried to jump our claim, Bill.
And the rest of his gang?
Them too.
Well, you made a clean sweep of it.
Nice of you to say so.
Wico Brindle's making noises about evening up on you two.
Is that right? He didn't show much fight the last time we saw him.
Wico's a bag of wind. He's a yellow belly.
Maybe we'd better talk to him again.
Watch out. He's a back shooter.
I hate back shooters. They don't deserve to live.
Deputy Osgood came over to them.
Hush up now. Gal's gonna tell her story.
He looked over the four of them.
This is law enforcement business. You don't belong here. All rights, I should put you out.
You would if you could.
Well, I might need to call on y'all to help out the law. What with Marshal Fred and the sheriff and them all out on the trail of them stage robbers. But no cutting up now here.
Well, we're here to help out.
Uh-huh. Where's them two bottles you promised?
I didn't forget. Things got kind of busy in the rush. I'll bring them along later. Honest.
See that you do.
The center of interest and the focus of all eyes was Linda Gordon, the young woman who'd fled Quirt Fane and Dorado at Cactus Patch. She sat in the marshal's chair, the most comfortable chair in the office. It had been moved out from behind the desk and put to one side of it. Those present grouped around her. Linda Gordon was 16, medium height, and weighed about 110 pounds. Her long blonde hair was the color and texture of pale yellow corn silk, spilling across her shoulders and down her back. Dark brown eyes contrasted with her fair hair and complexion. She was slender but nicely rounded where it counted. One of the women at Cactus Patch had fitted her out with a clean dress to replace her torn and dirty garments. She still wore her original shoes, a pair of lace-up flat-heeled ankle boots. Linda bore the marks of her ordeal, her well-tanned face showing exposure to the fierce desert sun. Her skin was peeling, her pale lips were cracked and parched, her face and arms were scratched, bruised. She sipped water from a tin cup, moistening her cracked lips. Nugget editor Harry Woods had strengthened it with a dash of brandy from his ever-ready pocket flask to brace her up. Woods prompted her in telling her story, Assistant Deputy Osgood's people skills being somewhat lacking, especially when it came to eliciting confidence and candor from young women.
You're safe here, among friends. No one can hurt you now. I hate to bother you after all you've been through, but the sooner we know what we're dealing with, the sooner we can get to work to do something about it. Now, Lindsay and Brown here told us some of it, but you're the only one who knows the whole story. The only one who can tell it all.
I'll tell. They did all they could to stop me from talking. Nothing could stop me now.
The Gordons, Mal, wife Fran, and daughter Linda, made their home in Bear Paw, a mining boom town on the front page of the Rockies near Denver, Colorado. Gordon was not a miner, but a farmer. Miners have to eat, though, and Gordon farmed a piece of land outside Bear Paw, raising crops to sell in town. Then the silver lode played out, and the boom went bust.
Most of the miners have already moved on, and only the diehards are left. Bear Paw's gone belly up. It'll be a ghost town soon. No miners, no market for our crops. The nearest market's down on the flat. It wouldn't pay to haul them down there. The wear and tear would kill off the horses, leaving us worse off than we are now. We have to move on in any case. We can't survive another winter in the mountains. This way, we have some place to move to. Now, Mal Gordon is nobody's fool. I've got sense enough not to believe a lot of pie-in-the-sky promises. The fact is that the land is there in Sacramento. The government's making it available to homesteaders. I've seen the proclamations, and so have you. And whatever it is, free California land's better than what we've got to look forward to here. All we've got to do is get there and take it.
California's a long way off, Mal. We got to cross mountains, then the desert, then more mountains before we even get there.
Nobody said it's going to be easy. If it was, they wouldn't be giving the land away. But it can be done. It has been done by men not as good as me. Lots of them. It's being done every day. It's not like the days of 49. The trail's blazed, well known. And we won't be alone. Others from Bear Paw are going too. Our friends, neighbors.
Friends, Mal?
Neighbors, anyhow. At least they're not strangers. No crooks or malingerers. Not much, anyhow.
So it was. It was a done deal. There was no other choice, not really. Bear Paw was already close to being a ghost town. There were no jobs to be found in Denver, Colorado Springs, or wherever. Not for Mal Gordon. He was a farmer, born and bred. Farming was what he did, and that's all there was to it. If he couldn't farm here, he'd farm somewhere else, on the far edge of the continent in the Sacramento River Valley, if need be. In all, 8 families decided to go. They sold their possessions to raise money for the trip, buying wagons, horses, provisions. July was their departure date. A late start, but it couldn't be helped. It took that long for the experts to confirm that the silver lode which had made the town was well and truly finished. The pilgrims crossed the mountain passes, descending the western range to the flat. They followed the old Santa Fe Trail to Taos in New Mexico territory and were joined by several wagons of emigrants along the way. From Taos, they set forth on the overland stagecoach route, winding southwest. It would ultimately take them through Arizona and Nevada territories, across the Sierra Nevadas, into California. The Bear Paw folks hoped to attach themselves to a larger wagon train for the rest of the journey, but few wagons were going west that season. Apache War Chief Victorio had jumped the reservation earlier in the year, taking hundreds of his braves with him. The Braves had unleashed bitter guerrilla warfare throughout their one-time home grounds in Arizona and New Mexico. In less than a year, they had slain close to 1,000 white settlers, men, women, and children. Many in the Bear Paw group were for stopping and turning back, but there was no real alternative. There was nothing to go back to, and if they stopped, they'd eventually run out of supplies and starve. Besides, the word was that Victorio and his tribe had fled south into the Sierra Madres in Sonora, Mexico. The emigrants pressed on. A day's trek outside Lordsburg, the wagoneers made camp, bedding down for the night. The following dawn revealed that they'd been hit by horse thieves who'd stolen a string of the animals undetected. It spelled disaster for the victims, left without enough horses to make proper teams to haul their wagons. Mal managed to persuade the others to donate a horse or two each to make up the difference so their fellows could proceed. It was a tough sell, but he managed to make the case by mid-morning. As they were about to apportion the horses out to the victimized families, a stranger appeared. The newcomer was an emigrant like themselves, driving a Conestoga wagon. He was not alone. With him was a woman and another man. Trailing his wagon was a lead rope to which was secured a string of horses, the same horses that had been stolen the night before. The stranger hailed them, pulling up at their camp.
Howdy, folks. I'm Al Jensen. This here is my wife, Carol, and my nephew, Sonny Boy.
Al Jensen occupied the driver's seat of the wagon, his big-knuckled, oversized hands holding the long reins of his team. He was in his mid-40s, tall, with long limbs. His curly salt-and-pepper hair was textured like sheep's wool. Tricky, mutton-chop side whiskers came down his cheeks, arching into a mustache and beard. His worn oval face was tobacco-colored from sun and weathering. Warm, moist brown eyes nestled in rings of laugh lines. Seated beside him was his wife, Carol. She was about 30. A big, floppy, colorless sunbonnet covered much of her face and head. Reddish brown hair was tied up at the back of her neck. Her skin was a metallic golden brown. She had wide, dark eyes, sharp cheekbones, sunken cheeks, and a full-lipped mouth turned down at the corners. Sonny Boy, too, was deep-chested and strongly made. He was in his late 20s, with black hair, green eyes, thick features, a strong jaw, and a dimpled chin. Broad-shouldered and narrow-waisted, he wore twin guns strapped down. A man named Henry McGee had decided he was the leader of the group and had some of the men walk up to the wagon with him.
Those are our horses, mister.
I know. I saw them when you were passing through Lordsburg yesterday. I meant to introduce myself then and see if I could tie in with you. But a wagon wheel needed fixing and we were delayed. Some fellas tried to steal our horses early this morning. Sonny Boy and me opened fire on them and laced into them pretty good, and they broke and run.
Must have been the same bunch that hit us. What'd they look like?
Didn't get too close a look at them. There was 3 of them, Mexes or breeds, I'd say. I think we hit one. There was blood on the ground. When they ran, they lost this string of horses. We rounded them up. We didn't chase them. Didn't want to leave the missus alone, though Carol can take care of herself. She's a dang good ham with a Winchester, ain't you, dear?
Carol nodded.
We were lucky to come out of it well as we did. Thought we recognized the animals as belonging to you all.
Uncle Al's got an eye for horse flesh.
We're following the westward trail, same as you folks. I figured we'd run into you sooner or later. Glad it was sooner. A man can't afford to lose a horse out here.
Ain't that the truth?
Help yourself. I know you'll be glad to get your animals back.
The emigrants were relieved that Jensen wasn't going to make any fuss about ownership. The owners untied the rope, leading the string away.
You sure are a lifesaver, mister. We'd have been in a mighty tough spot if you hadn't come along now.
Folks have got to help out their neighbors on the trail. That's how I see it.
Me too, but it ain't everybody you find who feels that way. The fire's still going. Step down and have some coffee with us.
Don't mind if I do. Me and Sonny Boy will come along. Carol'll stick with the wagon. She ain't hungry anyway.
Presently, Jensen and Sonny Boy sat on the ground near the fire, drinking black coffee out of tin cups. McGee and some of the Bear Paw men joined them.
Where you bound, Mr. Jensen?
California. And call me Al.
Glad to, Al. I'm Henry McGee. Unity is strength, I always say. We'd admire to have you folks join up and travel with us for the rest of the way.
To tell the truth, Henry, I was hoping you'd ask. This is mighty lonesome country for three people in a wagon.
Al Jensen, Carol, and Sonny Boy joined the Bear Paw wagon train. Jensen proved to be a sociable fellow, a companionable fellow traveler. He threw himself into the life of the emigrants without overstepping his bounds. He was ever ready to pitch in, lending a helping hand. Never at a loss for cheerful comment, quip, or pleasantry, he was a quick study, quick to learn the names and kinship of the wagoneer families. He liked people, and they liked him. Even Mal Gordon warmed to him in his grudging, guarded way. Linda Gordon thought Mr. Jensen was nice. Al Jensen's outgoing personality was balanced by the reclusive nature of his mate. Carol Jensen kept to herself, not exactly shunning the society of the other wives and mothers, but not seeking it out either. She wasn't one to coo over the youngsters, whose energetic antics she tolerated with tight-lipped taciturnity. Some of the wives thought she was unsociable because of the scar on her face, that it made her self-conscious around other people. Sonny Boy was physically strong, a crack shot, and a fine horseman, three attributes respected by the men of the caravan. Sometimes he drank too much, causing his Uncle Al to have to rein him in with a sharp word several times. When tipsy, Sonny Boy was an amiable buffoon, clumsy but harmless, or so it seemed. After several days' travel southwest along the trail, the wagon train stopped at Buckdun Station, a stagecoach way station and fly-speck town grown up at a crossroads where a spring bubbled forth out of the rocks. Al Jensen took Henry McGee off to one side. Jensen's manner was excited-seeming, confidential.
Know who's eating lunch in the station dining room, Henry? Sime Simmons.
Don't believe I know the name, Al.
What? You've never heard of Sime Simmons? The famous Indian fighter and scout? Why, he's the best known and most respected hombre this side of the Rocky Mountains.
Is that a fact?
I hope to hell it is. He's led wagon trains without number westward through the Sierras to California without losing a man or a horse. Knows every pass and water hole along the trail. We'd be sitting pretty if we could hire him on as a guide.
We don't have much money, Al.
Me neither. Who does? But that works both ways. Simmons may not have much money. Maybe we can get him on the cheap. Guy in the wagon train's a whole lot safer and easier than hunting Apaches.
Some of the other men on the wagon train broached the same idea to McGee. Seemed Sonny Boy had sung the praises of Simmons in their ears. After several of them came together to persuade McGee, he finally relented. Sime Simmons was in his late 40s, gray at the temples and a gray, speckled, sharp-pointed spade beard. Simmons had gray eyes, high cheekbones, and a wide face. He wore a flannel shirt and a brown-fringed rawhide vest, red bandana, black denims, and cowboy boots. He wore a gun on his right hip.
A gun belt was worn over his shoulder, hanging a second gun butt under his left arm. Two men were with him, hard-bitten frontier types. McGee cautiously sounded out Simmons about a job as scout, Simmons expressing guarded interest without committing himself. He pointed out that he was traveling with two sidemen, partners, whose interests must be taken care of. Porgy Best had oily black hair combed in a rooster tail cut with long sideburns. Mort Donegan had close-cropped blonde hair and beard. His hair was so pale and yellow it was almost colorless. McGee stressed that neither he nor his fellows had much money.
I can see that. Tell you what I'll do. What you ain't got in money, I'll take in horses. Now, once we reach Sacramento, you folks won't need all your horses. Make up the difference in pay with horse flesh. I'll take care of my parts. Fact is, I've been eating red dirt and chasing Apaches and being chased by them for too many years now. I've been thinking of starting me a horse farm, and California looks like a good place to set down in.
A price was set and mutually agreed on, and the deal was made. The wagon train left Buckton Station with Simmons riding point, sided by Best and Donegan. The convoy made its way south by southwest through New Mexico into Arizona. Brown and black mountains and yellow sands gave way to gray-black mountains and red dirt. The wagon train made camp for the night in Yellow Snake Canyon, a half mile north of the trail. A twisty, narrow cut, it was bordered by sharp-edged, razor-backed rock ridges. Its red-brown-yellow floor was boulder-studded and thick with cactus. A sweet scent of wild-growing aloe permeated the site.
We're in Apache country, Victorio's land. Now, Victorio and most of his bucks are down in Mexico, but that don't mean some of the war parties ain't gone north on their own to do some raiding. This is a box canyon, so we can only be approached from one direction. The canyon mouth is easily hailed. There ain't been no Apache sign in these parts all summer, and I don't expect to run across any of them red devils now, but it pays to take all due precautions. Me and the boys will be keeping watch all night, so don't you folks stay up fretting and worrying. Get a good night's sleep. We got a big day ahead tomorrow.
Don't nobody go wandering. Now with all them snakes around in the rocks, they don't call this Yellow Snake Canyon for nothing. Them snakes is rattlers.
Stay together, sleep in your wagons, and you'll be fine.
Linda Gordon didn't stay in her wagon, not all night. She woke up an hour or two before dawn. She had to answer a call of nature. She didn't want to leave the wagon, but there was no help for it. She wore a nightdress. She pulled on a pair of boots and slipped out of the back of the wagon without waking up her folks, Mal and Fran. The moon was low, and there was plenty of moonlight to see by. She stepped carefully, afraid of stepping on a rattlesnake. Her ears were pitched for the telltale sign of a reptilian rattle. She didn't want to go far from the wagon. A few men were standing and talking around the campfire, which had burned low. Sonny Boy, Sime Simmons, and his two side men. Linda was embarrassed to have them see her going to do her business, so she kept the wagon between herself and them. A man-high rocky outcropping was a stone's throw away. She went to it. She didn't want to climb over it for fear of stumbling over a rattlesnake den in the rocks, so she went around it, behind the back of it. Suddenly, she saw that riders were approaching the mouth of the canyon.
Apaches!
Linda looked back to see that the men in the camp were the ones shooting off their guns. Carl Haber stuck his head out the back of the wagon.
What is it, Indians?
Sonny Boy shot him. A horrible mistake, thought Linda, frozen in place, peeking around a jagged rock edge. Sonny Boy must have lost his head and shot Mr. Haber by accident. Lily Haber popped up in the back of the wagon, clutching the top of the closed tailgate.
Carl!
She saw Sonny Boy standing nearby with a smoking gun.
You killed my husband!
I killed you, too.
A half dozen riders came tearing into camp, reining in hard just short of the wagons grouped in a circle. They started firing their guns along with the others. They weren't Apaches, though. Not even Indians. They were white men. Henry McGee jumped down from his wagon, six gun in hand. He darted into the circle of firelight.
Henry! Over here!
McGee looked around to see who'd called his name. It came from Al Jensen, seated on the driver's seat of his wagon, fully dressed and with his hat on.
It's an attack, Al!
Al Jensen shot him in the chest. McGee fell face forward into the dirt. Lon Brum and Chris Hooper were down from their wagon and had started shooting at Jensen as soon as they saw what he did. Suddenly, someone stepped into view from behind a nearby wagon. The muzzle flares underlit the shooter's face, revealing Syme Simmons, his eyes and mouth slits. He looked infinitely cruel, vicious. The riders who'd stormed into the canyon jumped down from their horses, running around the wagon, circling them. They thrust gun hands inside the overarching canvas tents, shooting every male bear paw immigrant they found, man and boy. One of the newcomers stuck his head in the back of Gordon's wagon. Mal Gordon jumped down from the wagon, double-barreled shotgun in hand. Mort Donegan shot him. Mort moved off in search of other prey. Mal Gordon wasn't dead. He rose shakily, clutching the shotgun in one hand. He spread his feet wide apart, bracing himself to keep from falling. He gripped the shotgun in both hands, swinging it toward Mort Donegan's back. Donegan prowled around, too intent on finding fresh prey to realize that imminent doom loomed behind him. Mal Gordon dropped. Linda stuffed a fist in her mouth to keep from screaming. Carol Jensen stood there, holding a leveled Winchester hip high, a tendril of smoke wriggling from the barrel. Mort Donegan saw her and waved.
Thanks!
When you shoot a man, kill him!
Next time I will!
Be more careful or there won't be a next time!
Yes, ma'am!
Donegan went off, looking for more immigrants to slay. This was no battle, this was a massacre, punctuated by sporadic, largely ineffectual gunfire from those attacked. They went from wagon to wagon, killing the males where they found them and dragging out the females. Women and girls were herded around the campfire. The gunman took orders from Al Jensen, who was not shy about giving them. Al and Carol went among the females, selecting out all the wives, mothers, and older women, leaving behind the teenagers and young girls. Al Jensen stood in a posture of dominance over the youngsters, hat tilted back, hands on hips, booted legs spread wide.
You belong to Black Angus now.
Linda Gordon knew what she had to do. Her parents were dead. There was nothing she could do to help the other girls. It would only be a matter of time before Al Jensen or one of the insiders who'd traveled with the wagon train noticed her absence and set the others searching for her. She couldn't stay where she was. The night sky was lightning and the sun would soon come up. While the gunman led the women away, she sneaked out from behind the rock outcropping where she'd been hiding. One of the riders had hitched his horse to a rear wheel of the Gordon's wagon. Bent low, almost double, she snuck over to it. Linda was trembling so hard she almost couldn't stand. The horse was a big black. The bulk of the wagon mostly screened her from view of those inside the circle. She picked at the reins, knotted around a spoke of the rear wagon wheel. She plucked at the reins and they came undone. Linda fisted the reins, turning the horse, walking it away from the wagon. She expected an outcry any second, but no one had yet noticed her. She gripped the pommel, climbing into the saddle. Linda kicked her heels into the horse's flanks, urging it forward.
One's getting away! Stop her!
Darkness concealed her, and the shooters couldn't see to hit her.
Get her! Don't let her get away!
She got away, galloping out of the canyon south across the flat. Linda Gordon was emotionally and physically exhausted from her ordeal. Telling her story to those gathered in the marshal's office had left her weak, drained.
She needs rest, and lots of it.
She needs justice, and she'll by God have it, as long as I've got a breath in me.
Linda looked up at Matt from where she was sitting, a look of mingled gratitude and appeal in her eyes.
Colonel Davenport has taken a personal interest in the girl. He's arranged for a room for her at the hotel. A doctor is there waiting to look after her. We'll need a carriage to take her to the hotel.
I'll have one of the boys scare one up.
A short time later, the carriage arrived. A four-seater open cab drawn by a single horse. Stebbins and Marcand would escort Linda Gordon to the hotel. Sam put a hand on Stebbins' arm, leading him aside.
What?
Tell Davenport to put a couple of guards on the girl. Men who can take care of themselves and know how to handle a gun.
Is that really necessary?
I wouldn't say it if I didn't think it was. Angus Jones, alias Black Angus, alias Al Jensen, is one of the worst bandit chiefs in the territory. He's got a gang of killers at his beck and call. His spies and contacts are everywhere, including right here in Tombstone. Linda Gordon's testimony can put a noose around his neck for the killings at Yellow Snake Canyon, but only if she lives to get to trial.
Surely the danger to the girl is past now that she's safe in town.
What makes you think so?
Why, surely with all these people around, no one would try to harm her.
Who's going to stop them, Osgood? The rest of the lawmen are chasing the Wells Fargo robbers, and there's no telling when they'll be back. Black Angus sent Quirt and Dorado after the girl, two of his best men. He might be anywhere, outside town with the rest of his gang, maybe. You're new to these parts, so you may not appreciate the seriousness of the matter, but I warn you, don't underestimate Black Angus.
I'll take it under advisement.
Don't take it under advisement. Do it. The colonel's got plenty of bodyguards from what I saw at the hotel. It'll be easy to assign a couple to Linda. You're a bookkeeper, Stebbins, a man who appreciates the importance of the bottom line. Well, here it is. Like you said, the colonel is taking an interest in the girl. Where will that leave you if something bad happens to her right under your nose? Especially after I've warned you to take proper precautions.
I see what you mean. Everything will be done to assure Miss Gordon's safety.
I'll hold you to it. And I mean just that. I'll hold you to it. Lord help you if something happens to that girl, because I surely won't.